Welcome to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm your host, Celine Diaris, the founder and executive director of At the Epicenter. And with me today is Dan Kittredge, founder and executive director of the Bionutrient Food Association, whose mission is to increase quality in the food supply. I love that mission statement, Dan, and I'm sort of interested to dive in there about the meaning of something that intense of how do we, you know, to say there needs to be a quality question to our food supply.
Was that a question?
That is a question.
Okay.
Why is this your mission?
Why is it our mission?
Yeah.
Because we think it connects to so many other really important things. People may have heard of the term nutrient density, which is something we've been helping to popularize over the past decade or so. And it effectively refers to the fact that, when one tomato from the grocery store tastes different than the tomato from your garden, that taste difference correlates pretty directly with the nutritional difference. And that effectively you've had the experience of a carrot tasting really good or not tasting particularly good, or a peach fresh off of the tree, ripe, or a peach off the grocery store shelf that turned pulpy after being hard. You know, in our USDA averages, those are considered to be the same, where actually, from a nutritional standpoint, they can have hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of percent variation in nutrient levels. And so, from a very foundational standpoint, I think we have been, in general, through the dominant supply chain, having food available to us, which is actually relatively quite low in nutritive value. And that comes from agricultural practices that are fairly destructive. It ends up having toxins in the water supply, dead zones in the ocean, cancer in the school children, all kinds of negative systemic effects, not to mention the carbon in the atmosphere and all that. So what we understand is that when plants are growing more in harmony with nature, they actually are healthier. They have a stronger immune system, which means they have higher levels of these secondary metabolites, these things we call flavor and aroma. Those compounds that make something taste good are the things that signify its health, that correlate with the health of the environment it was grown in. And so
I'm going to interrupt you just for a moment and just say that the flavor, the taste, the aroma of food is correlative to its nutrient density is a pretty powerful self-identified opportunity for people.
We don't need any kind of fancy certification and labeling and marketing and everything else if we just realize that we're actually animals who have inbuilt, very sophisticated nutrient monitoring devices. And we've become inured to the fact that most food doesn't taste good because that's, in many cases, all we've ever experienced. I mean, now we're a couple generations into most people not having grown up on a farm or had access to a farm and not having really experienced things that were grown well. And we've kind of forgotten that actually the answers are already within us. So...
I agree with you. I'm a big advocate of, our skill of observation, of our capacity to bear witness and come up with insight. And it frustrates me that we have become so hyper data oriented that we've, in essence, sort of abandoned the cultivation of common sense and basic observational skills that are really necessary for a high functioning human being.
You can, someone may be able to convince you in your mind about something that, they must know better. That may be such a good argument. They must have the answer, but in your gut, whether you feel expansive and warm and open or closed and hurt and pushed. I mean, we actually are wired on multiple levels to discern what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. And I anyway.
No, I mean, we can go there just a little bit. I mean, I opened the door, didn't I? But I think it's not it is an important aspect. I'm reading a book right now called Regenerative Leadership. And it starts with an overview of what is the journey of how humans became so separated from nature, and how that evolution of thought has really robbed us of our inherent, as you say, our wiring, what we're really innately capable of perceiving and knowing. Mm-hmm. And we've been taught to distrust that.
And that's the colonized, industrialized, patriarchal, reductionist mindset, which we are all victims of. You know, it's not like the white men are not lost in that mentality, or the white women. We're all lost in that mentality, and we're all operating from, you know, not having been brought up with the indigenous knowing of these deeper things. Or, you know, in the East, I guess their science laid it out pretty elegantly too. I think these are some of the deeper systemic issues at play. And I really think that we're all in it together.
I agree.
The sooner we realize that and start working systemically, the more rapidly we can turn things around.
Agreed. And it's interesting how important a role food plays in our health. I think many of us have heard food is your best medicine. And if you haven't heard that, note, food is your best medicine. However, as Dan will share a little bit more with us, is the food that you're eating, it really does matter what food it is, whether or not you're deriving true nutritional value from that food. So share a little bit about what you've been learning over the last decade of focusing on this topic.
I'll give you a simple aphorism first, or a simple metaphor, and then we can go into all the fancy numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to say, is it junk or is it food? You know, I mean, a lot of the stuff that you get in the store should not properly be called food. If we're going to say, let food be thy medicine, food is the best medicine, then you need to discriminate between, you know, this carrot and that carrot, or this bag of potato chips is properly not food. So let's just start calling it junk, right? I mean, there's not junk and food. They don't go together. There's either junk or there's food. And so just from a semantic standpoint, if we can start using the language that identifies these things as that's junk, that's not food, then we'll be able to actually have this conversation more deeply. But anyway, that's just a little rant I like to go on. I don't think that's a question you're actually looking for me to answer.
Well, I don't think it is an insignificant part of, you know, our powdered covered donuts, junk or food?
Yeah.
They're definitely junk.
But some of the organic carrots are also junk.
Yeah, and I think that's something that is a little troubling, because how do I know when I go to, I'm fortunate, I live in a place where I'm a member of a CSA, and I go and get whatever vegetables are currently in harvest in my food share. But that's only, you know, something I have access to a certain portion of the year. Then I'm relegated, just like everybody else, to go to the store and, you know, hope I'm getting decent nutrient dense food.
You get it as best you can, but it's, in most cases, it's pretty bad, is the short answer. So what have we learned? You know, what are we working on? Is that what your question was a minute ago?
Well, I mean, my question is, I mean, you're working on this. You have some initiatives underway that we can talk about. But also, I guess I'm curious in your mind, you know, what is the bridge from where we are currently to where we could be in terms of truly nutrient-dense food? How long of a distance do we have to cover to get there?
Read the future and tell me what it looks like.
My crystal ball.
I mean, from a practical standpoint, any farmer, any gardener, at the beginning of the growing season, if they were to just change their practices, could get a profound increase in nutrient levels in that season. So the issue is not, you know, is it going to take 5 years for any piece of soil to be managed differently? The issue is, how do we incentivize that soil to be treated differently? How do we change the rationale, the motivation structures of the people managing the soil so that it is treated differently, so that it does sequester carbon, so that it does, you know, all these other things, and it does produce food that is more nutritious. And so, you know, what we as an organization have been doing is, you know, trying to tease out some of these, you know, the basic dynamics and the sort of, and we've come up with a strategy. So I'll just, you know, delineate that here quickly. Our first thought is that money talks, and that, you know, there's all kinds of great ideas out there in the world about wouldn't it be wonderful if this happened. But if you don't have a practical plan to go from here to there, then it's just basically a fantasy and you should relegate it as such. And so our thought is, you know, while there's lots of good ideas out there in the world, money seems to drive a lot of people's decisions from a foundational standpoint. And so if we can align economic incentive with nutrient density, with, you know, reducing chronic illness and, you know, improving health and increasing soil carbon and ecological health, if we can align economic incentive, then we may have a viable path forward in the short time frame we have before cataclysm really becomes quite pronounced.
Right.
And so our thought is we need to give consumers the ability to choose at the point of purchase, whether it's the grocery store or the farmer's market, between the better version or the worst one. So if you've got, I use the example of carrots, I say, you know, you got your Caliganic carrots, you got your Bunny Love carrots, and you got your Bolthouse Farm carrots. Let's say theoretically that one of them is in the 20th percentile of what a carrot could be. One of them's in the 40th percentile. One's in the 80th percentile. That might mean that the one in the 80th percentile is about, on average, 8 times more nutritious than the one in the 20th percentile. That's what we've found when we've looked at the data. Like, the variation is not, you know, 50% variation. It's 800% or 8,000% variation, depending on the nutrients. So if you could choose the one that was in the 80th percentile versus the one that was in the 20th percentile, would you? Would you choose the one that was more flavorful, that was more nutritious, over the one that was less flavorful, nutritious? And our thought is that maybe not everybody would, but a lot of people would. And so how do you do that? How do you actually test what's in food? And the answer to that question is through a science called spectroscopy. And to explain that, I like to use the example of, you know, stars. Alpha Centauri is a star that's a few light years away from us. And any astrophysicist will tell you, we know exactly what Alpha Centauri is made up of. It's 51% hydrogen, it's 48% helium, it's 1% other gases. We know that. And you're like, well, you know, Voyager was the, you know, starship that's gone the farthest away from Earth, and it's only made it to the edge of the solar system, which is 12 light hours away. So how the hell did you figure out what something 5 light years away is made up of? And it's not by going there and sampling it. It's by reading light, that every element in chemistry, like copper or zinc or compound, like vitamin B or vitamin D or, you know, polyphenols, all those things in chemistry are actually vibrations in physics, which means they're light. And so there's red light and blue light and green light. There's all these different types of light. And so we take a picture of the light coming off of Alpha Centauri. We can see what it's made up of. If you can read what something 5 light years away is made up of, you should be able then
something right there.
Part of you is made up of.
Right.
And so that's the idea, is we build a little gizmo that you can flash a light at the carrot and it'll say 20th percentile, 40th percentile. So that's the sort of, you know, step one of our process. We call the Real Food Campaign, which is a collaboration of multiple different organizations, nonprofits, universities, companies, foundations, et cetera, who are all working on this broader project. Step one is, or, you know, one leg of the stool is build a tool that can be used to test quality, nutrient density, variation of nutrient levels. Two is to figure out what the variation is, because there's no data set anywhere that says, this is what a poor quality carrot consists of, this is what a high quality carrot consists of. Nobody's done the research. So set up a lab in Ann Arbor in Michigan and started running samples in 2018. We set up another lab in at Chico State in California last year, and we've got another lab going in France this year. So we're basically, you know, working broadly, you know, I guess just 2 continents now, but just people in other parts of the world that want to be part of this process. So we're sending in samples. of crops from farms, from grocery stores. We're sort of identifying variation. And then step three is to figure out what caused the variation. So most of the samples that we're sending into the lab are coming from farms where we have asked the farmers a long list of questions. What's your soil type? What's your fertility program? What are your management practices? Did you cover crop? Did you till? How deeply did you till? What kind of fertilizer did you use? Did you use any inoculant? What was the variety of seed you used? Because we want to be able to correlate nutrient variations with management practices. The last thing we want to do is have the farmer go to their buyer and say, you know, here's my crops. And the buyer says, oh, don't want it. Right? We're farmers. I'm a farmer. Our core organizational constituency is farmers. And we want farmers to be supported. All farmers on all continents of all scales. So basically we've got this process now where we take the crops and the soil they grew in and the metadata of how they were produced. We run them through a lab. We flash our little gizmo at them. We get the spectral signature. We test all the mineral levels and the compound levels. And we've got this big, complicated data set from which we can learn what causes quality, what correlates with practice with carbon sequestration, what correlates with nutrient variation, so that we can, in a totally transparent and open source fashion, share with anybody globally who wants to know how to do a better job. Because right now there's not really any proper database about, like, in this soil type, in this climate zone, what are the best practices, the least cost to get me the best result, to sequester more carbon, to do all these things. There is no answer. Nobody's figured it out because it's nuanced and every situation is a little bit unique. Anyway, it's a long, complicated.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, one question that pops into my mind is there, as you mentioned, you know, it's like what seeds are there? Is there a correlation also being made around what variety of, let's use carrots as an ongoing example, if a certain type of carrot is much better at absorbing nutrients from a particular type of soil versus another variant of carrot, so that there's also maybe some knowledge around which species would be best in different climates and soil types?
Not only variety, but epigenetics also.
Really?
So, you know, a lot of the hybridized seeds were bred to get big fast and to grow well under a chemical fertilizer system. So if your market is looking for volume and aesthetic, then you, as a farmer, would probably want to be choosing the hybrid seeds because those are the ones that have been bred to function in that sort of market practice. But a lot of the open pollinated heirloom varieties of seeds were saved based on the ability to grow well in soil, to have big root systems, to be pest and disease resistant, and to be flavorful. And so it sure looks like a lot of the older varieties of seeds actually have a much better inherent capacity to be more nutritious. That's just something that got sort of lost in the industrialization process.
Right.
The other part of it is the health of the mother. So the health, as with a cow or a chicken or a human, the health of the mother has a lot to do with the health of the baby and, of course, health of the father. It's exactly that way with plants. So the health of your mother plant will have a direct effect on the vigor and vitality and capacity of the seed. And so there's all these pieces of the puzzle that, you know, if you look in the literature, you can see, okay, we know that from there, we know that from there, we know that from there, but nobody's ever put them all together into one big open collaborative data set that everybody can plug into, is not controlled by any company or organization. And that's our thought, is we crowdsource this deeper knowledge, use the language of science, but use the model of nature, of symbiosis, to begin figuring these things out. Your initial question is, what's our time frame? So I would say, you know, we've got our first generation little gizmo. I've got one here. We call it the bionutrient meter, and it's a, you know, it works. It's a spectrometer. It's got a, you know, it's Bluetooth to your smartphone. It's got a little, you know, the light flashes there, and it's between 62 and 70% predictive, I think, is where we're at right now. So that's not great, but it's something, you know, on a, like a low, medium, high. So flash a light that says this is high on the top third of the percentiles, 65% odds that's correct. So that's not great, but it's where we're at now. We are in the process of redesigning the spectrometer. This is not designed also for mass production and sort of slick consumer use. It's like more of a, I don't know, like an Apple One, you know, not an Apple Two. The Apple One was not really supposed to be going out to consumers, but the Apple Two was. It's not an iPhone for sure. So, I would say, you know, 18 to 24 months, we will likely have a next generation spectrometer in the market that is well calibrated, that will be able to apply direct economic leverage in the supply chain by causing the bunny loves to stay on the shelf and having the, you know, the Calorganics or whatever's leave the shelf.
That's well, maybe problem. Rather than leave the shelf, improve their farming practices.
No.
That's the option.
If the word gets out, like I use the example of you know, Stonyfield and Organic Valley. If somebody was to test, say 50 people around the country were to test, were to buy a jug of Organic Valley and a jug of Stonyfield, and 48 of them were to get the same answer, that we'll say Stonyfield is better, that would get out there in social media. And my guess is that Stonyfield would start leaving the shelves and Organic Valley would stay there. So that's how the economic incentive works, is when the consumers have, you know, a new data point, which is like this company stuff generally is better. Then there's going to be a race to the top. That's our hope.
Right. So we, Organic Valley versus Stonyfield, that information doesn't actually exist right now. So we won't create misinformation. I know you were using that as an example. And I just wanted to go back to, you know, the other example in naming some companies. I would hope too that part of the work is to onboard large growers, because I'm very interested in this person in the work of my organization, is getting companies to lean into their responsibility and opportunity to become better stewards and to become part of a solutional network of farming around the planet, where we're putting a lot more focus on creating healthy soils, which means a lot less disturbance, more diversity of plants planted together. I mean, it makes sense. Just, and this is why I like to sort of remind us that we have common sense as an ally. Because if you stop and think about, if I were to plant one thing all the time, then the demand of that one thing on that soil substrate would be the same. And therefore, it's not a great distance to travel to go, that's going to deplete that soil of its diverse mix of nutrients if I'm only putting one thing that's extracting what it needs every cycle, and I'm not doing anything to replenish, to give it new, to give the microbes in the soil new things to enjoy, to diversify their diets, to have a healthy life cycle of their own. And so that has been pretty much ignored in conventional and some organic production cycles, that the soil has been really ignored and left out of the equation. And sort of back to your beginning about how money is so significant in our reality, that has fueled some inaccurate assessments of what's important.
Perversions of reality. Yeah, I mean, to your point, nature works with polycultures. You know, you don't find in nature just one plant growing in an area. I like to use the example of the gut flora. You know, a cow has a different gut flora than a chicken, who has a different gut flora than a rabbit. So it shouldn't be too much of a jump to understand that an oat has a different gut flora than a cucumber, than an apple tree. And you know, it's when you have the most broad spectrum of microbes in the soil that you have the greatest level of fecundity, vitality, you know, flavor, immunity, all those things in the plants that are growing there. So yeah, monocultures by nature are going to be inherently, you know, less capable of producing high levels of nutrition than polycultures. However, most monocultures are being managed in an extraordinarily destructive fashion. And so absolutely, you can still do a hell of a lot better job with a monoculture than is being done. So it's going to be a process. And we are working with some fairly large companies in the supply chain as part of this process. We've got some small local organic farming organizations and some big multinational corporations and some universities. We're non-dogmatic. We really are receptive to anybody who wants to be involved. And we're saying, the sooner you get involved and help figure out your supply chain, your production practice, the sooner you're going to have, you know, insight about how to do a better job. And if this shift in the market is, you know, imminent, you're going to want to be positioned well when that occurs. So our only rule is that we are transparent, that we're open source, that we're not engaging in like proprietary data collection. We're doing this for the commons.
I love that.
So if you're willing to play along on those rules, we welcome pretty much anybody. And as a nonprofit, we are only able to go as fast as the resources we have available to us, which are coming in the form of charitable donations. So if you're a company and you want to put money into this, it's not a pay to play kind of a thing where you get your proprietary data. Like, it has to go through this process of openness and sharing. And that's been a bit of a, what's the word? Bottleneck.
I would imagine. I mean, we are at a kind of a, I've been saying this in talks I've been giving, you know, to me, we're at an inflection point. And part of that inflection point is transitioning from the notion of pure competition to cooperation. And we have been all indoctrinated into this idea of hyper-individualism, especially in the United States. We've been indoctrinated with the idea of, you know, mine and yours, and I'm going to protect that, and, you know, you're somebody I have to be sort of vigilant about, and what's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours. So all of that long-standing indoctrinational frameworks have really created that bottleneck you're talking about in terms of people starting to become more comfortable with transparency, with cooperation and collaboration, especially when you're talking about competitors who maybe in the marketplace have carrots on that shelf and they're playing off of each other. And it's scary, I realize, to be vulnerable in that way. And at the same time, it's like there's so much at stake. There's the health of the people. There's the health of our land and our water and our air and our planet itself that is deeply interwoven with this conversation that we're having about how we treat the land and the water and our relationship to it from a stewarding, nurturing, cultivating its highest evolution, so that we are then nourished by that. So it is a deeply reciprocal relationship that in many ways we've lost that thread.
Yeah. And, you know, nature's taken us out because of it. So it's, you know, we either find it or we're dead. That's, you know, we've been saying it for years. It's like, we know what's coming down the pike. We don't know exactly when or exactly how, but, you know, you get out of line with nature and she takes you out. That's the way it works. So let's figure out how to get back into line with nature so that when people are in a place where they're actually like, oh God, we actually have to do this or else we're dead, that we've got a really smooth glide path to rapid, you know, system transition that's not confrontational or adversarial, but deeply collaborative. So
exactly. And I think,
yeah,
as you know, our runway is rather short. It gets shorter every year because we keep equivocating. What was that?
It's exciting now because gotten to a point where it's like people begin to see. What's the biggest problem is that people don't understand how rapidly we can rejuvenate the planet or vitality on the planet. That's the biggest issue, is that there's a sort of like complacency of like, we're doomed.
Right.
And that's, you know, the question for me is, how do we break through with a story that people feel empowered by? And my experience is, you know, we've got our little shiny object, you know, here's a little shiny object, and it can tell you a story that goes along with it, which is, you know, when you eat food that is flavorful, you have more energy. You are likely to have whatever chronic illnesses you may have or your family may have dissipate, depending on how good your food is. Like, this is a natural effect of nutrition. And the process of growing that food is a process of carbon sequestration and, you know, global cooling and soil revitalization. That's the only way it happens, is when the soil is built.
Yes. You
can grow high quality food by destroying the soil, because the way the food is grown is by making sugar and feeding the soil life, which are then turning into soil organic matter. That's the only way it works. And so,
You falsify that process with, you know, artificial accelerants in growth and nitrogens and other things. That
you get volume, but you won't get quality.
Well, exactly. And that's back to, you know, you're talking about increasing quality in the food supply, which also, when you have healthier plants, you have more life around you. And therefore, you know, a tomato plant produces more tomatoes.
Actually, your cost of production goes down. Actually, your economic viability goes up. Actually, your plant has pest and disease resistance, so you don't need insecticides and fungicides.
Yeah, so exactly.
The pollinators are coming back because you're not using those chemicals. We actually, what is it, 10 billion acres of or hectares of ag land on the planet? I mean, like, there's a bunch of land that's being managed in a destructive fashion, that if we shifted the incentive, would be managed in a you know, regenerative, constructive fashion, and we can sequester carbon all day long. We can,
exactly,
not a problem.
You're listening to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm your host, Celine Diaris, and with me today is Dan Kittredge, the founder and executive director of the Bionutrient Food Association. You know, what you were just saying, Dan, about the extraordinary like opportunity in front of us, which I don't even understand. This is just, I guess, expresses my own bias, but like, I have a hard time comprehending the pushback against the things we're talking about. It's challenging for me to understand, given the global conditions that are affecting everyone in every climate. I was just on a call with a friend in New Zealand, and they were talking about how the patterns of weather have dramatically changed in that place between the two islands, and that it's essentially like, I'm in Colorado and we are seeing extraordinary changes in precipitation in an already semi-arid environment, and moving towards even drier. I mean, we are setting ourselves up for being part of the desertification pattern on our planet. Mm-hmm. So these are, it's global, it's everywhere. Food is grown in every climate on the planet. So, well, okay, with a few exceptions, but by and large, you know, there's a lot of interaction between us and the natural lands around us. What, in your experience, do you think is the current obstacle that still prevents a broader yes to this type of agriculture?
Yeah, I mean, you started out that question with, you know, the statement that there's a lot of pushback, and you know, I wouldn't say there's so much pushback really, except perhaps with some of the people who were deeply scientifically, you know, programmed, and say, well, until you show me the citation in the literature, I can't support your idea. So, you know, part of the problem, as I understand it, is that the way that agricultural science has been done has been, we're going to study this one thing. We're going to study the levels of copper in soil and how it connects to whatever. And you can study this one thing, and you can study that one thing, and you can study that one thing, but life is millions of things, and you can never study them all and control them all separately. You have to look at them in a relationship to each other. So from my perspective, you know, when we do get the science done, which I don't think we're too far away from having it, that shows how all these things are directly interrelated, that will, you know, get us over one of the most systemic hurdles that are in place, which is, you know, skepticism. And if we can have the categorical data, which says, look, here's the relationships, here's how it functions, here's the variation, here's the process. You know, I think the way we're designing the work is, you know, should accomplish that. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is just the story and the public and the, you know, the zeitgeist. I think what we're proposing is foundationally extremely threatening to many large industries.
That's where I'm pointing when I say there's
we have
resistance. You know,
the pharmaceutical industry, we have, you know, medical devices, we've got agribusiness, we've got,
oil and gas.
Just think about all the different industries who will, chemicals. We are not going to need insecticides and fungicides when plants are healthy. You don't need fertilizer when plants are working with the microbiome. You don't need, you don't need a lot of these things that are functionally currently very profitable. So there's no real incentive to talk about it in those circles. And so, the question is, how do we, a broader social movement, coalesce around an idea and tell the story broadly when our modes of communication are relatively well controlled, right? I mean, you're not going to find this in the New York Times or Washington Post, probably because it's not really in the interest of the people that are paying their bills, or Fox or CNN or MSNBC. You're probably not going to hear this story there because it's not in their agenda. The more of us that understand and share, the better. I really do think until we can shift the economic incentive, until we can make it so that companies are going to be making more money by getting on the bandwagon than by staying off because the consumers have already left the station, until we can actually have that economic driver, I'm skeptical that we're going to have any significant forward motion. That's why we're working as fast as we can on this project, because we think it'll actually facilitate that shift. But, you know, we're doing it in an open source way. And so people that have money generally like to get a return on an investment. And then, you know, we're not offering a return on an investment because we're trying to do it openly so it can't be controlled and co-opted. So there's your chicken and your egg. We're making progress.
I'm glad that you're making progress. And I think that, you know, when you talk about a new narrative and how do we create that incentivized opportunity, both for the farmer and for the public, for the citizen to go, you know what, I see and understand this thing about quality that matters to me. And I want that for my family. So what's interesting to me in the broader conversation in agriculture right now around, you know, does this sequester more carbon or not? And that has become this kind of, for me, a disappointing subversion of what we really should be talking about, which is long-term well-being across all these multiples of considerations, which includes us, which includes the land and the biodiversity on our planet. And again, kind of, I think I'm going to say this probably four more times in our conversation, common sense is so vital for people to be re-empowered with their own observational capacity, to have that reawakened as their part of their native intelligence as the animal that we are, and that if we can create an empowering story that people become, you know, that the whole idea that there's a they is shifted to, it's a we have the power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We really are the choosers. The economy is us. Therefore, if we decide these things matter and we start to direct our hard-earned dollars toward that which has been proven to be better for us, then as you say, I mean, it's like the citizen has left the station and is going down the path that says, this is important. This is not something we are going to compromise on any longer, because look at the state of us. We're overweight, we're sick.
This is not for the greater good. It happens to be for the greater good, but it's in my self-interest. You know, my skin, my libido, my energy, like just basic things, you know, like
your brain, my thoughts, my
ability to think clearly, my energy during the day, like is improved when you're healthier, and you're healthier when you eat better food and what you have available to you in the supply chain is junk. And so that's why you're not, I mean, this is visceral self-interest.
Exactly.
And sequesters carbon and can heal the environment. Okay, great.
That's nice. I like to call that enlightened self-interest.
I use that term myself often. Yes.
So it's like playing on our selfishness as individuals. We're all, you know, just look at how toilet paper left the stores around the country. People are like, I don't care if you have yours. I'm going to be sure I have mine. So we know that we are innately often self-centered and self-serving. So if we acknowledge that, how do we utilize that inclination in a positive way for the improvement of the commons, for the improvement for our shared well-being? And it's very interesting to me, and I'm curious what you are doing, if this is part of the work you all are doing, if you have other organizations that you know of that are really working on the correlation between chemicals in the food system and water supply and air, lack of nutrient density in food, and inflammatory disease and obesity and lowering IQs and reduced numbers and, you know, fertility are, I mean, all of these ultimately are interconnected because it's all of one big fabric, the complex big fabric of life on this planet.
If you grant that it's all interconnected, then sure, it's not hard to see the pattern. Part of this colonized mindset, this, you know, reductionist paradigm, is to think that this is separate from that. And so that's part of that's the real paradigm shift from my perspective, is to understand that everything is actually interconnected, that life is what's running the show here. That, you know, you may be able to prove something in a test tube, and good for you, but that doesn't mean that life's not in charge still.
Exactly.
I don't know.
I think one of the things you were saying a little earlier that I want to come back to is really vitality, and that life itself is extraordinarily tenacious. Mm-hmm. And we underestimate the healing capacity of our ecosystems, given, you know, some support from us, the ability of life to start to recover is extraordinary. I think we could talk about the pandemic and how people witnessed life around them resurging just because we weren't out there trampling everything down and running our noxious cars and all the things that we normally do was tamped down so much. People were noticing this resurgence. So I hope that is something we can really utilize in this effort that we're both involved in, to point to that and say that is bearing witness to the extraordinary capacity.
That's one thing, and that's nice, and it's true, but there's a whole other level of it, which, you know, I mean, permaculturalists that have gone to the desert and, you know, built swales. I mean, they basically just did some ditches, and life comes back.
Yep.
I mean, there's massive amounts of this planet that are brown that nobody's doing any farming on, that are basically like written off, you know, I mean, billions and billions of acres of land that not where nothing grows. And if we were to apply the use of some of our machinery, some of our understanding, very, very simple things we could do, which would facilitate that rapid regeneration of the landscape. So, I mean, we do have an immense potential, and there are some people who know the stories, but it's a very small number of people. And so the question really is, you know, one of the questions is, how do you facilitate this other story being told? And that's yes. part of this Mycelia project that we've just started organizationally, which is, you know, like if we look at the fact that Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all these, you know, platforms, Google News, CNN, whatever, are not actively interested in telling the story of solutions. They, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. There's a, we can be skeptical about, you know, who actually owns Viacom, and they, you know, if you actually track down who owns which companies, then you can say, okay, well, now we understand why they're, you know, framing stories this way. But from a foundational standpoint, I would suggest that most people are very receptive to the good news, but they don't know where to find it and they don't have access to it. And so, you know, I think it's incumbent on us as a movement who understands these things, all the different people and organizations that you and I both know, you know, we do not have a common platform for showing ourselves, for showing what we understand, for helping people find local things they can do, helping people plug into their community. You know, we've been saying increasing quality in the food supply as our organizational mission, thinking that that was just literally food you eat. But in actual fact, we take in many other things that affect us. Our ideas, our emotions, the, you know, people around us affect us, our thoughts, the, you know, the things we read, the things we watch, affect our way of thinking, our way of engaging the world around us. And, until we can change our emotional, intellectual food supply, until we can change our spiritual food supply, you know, we're going to have a hard time, you know, paddling upstream. So that you know, a part of that thing with the spectrometer is like, okay, here's a way to discern and to make choices. This is another project we're, you know, working on in collaboration with others called Mycelia. And it's, you know, this idea that we can have all the functions of electronic communications, but not in a colonized, extractive data mining way, right? Right. We can have cryptographic security. We can have transparency and sharing and openness and collaboration and honor and symbiosis and empowerment through our electronic structures if we just build them with that principle in mind. So, yeah, I mean, it's an amazing opportunity because so much is apparently so existentially, like, you know, fearful, right? Like, oh my God, everything's falling apart. What's going to go on? Like, got nothing to lose.
Let's
what we think is the best thing to do. And like, we'll see what happens. Like,
and I think we'll have a lot more fun because it's, I mean, human beings need, it is, it's actually rewarding. It's rewarding to feel connection.
Selfish. It's actually selfish to do the right thing because you feel better afterwards, right?
When you, we'll need a new t-shirt. Do the right thing. Be selfish.
Selfish is selfless. Capital S. Like, what's in my best interest is in your best interest. Like, it's not true that it's good for me to have more than you, right? That does not, it's not actually true.
I mean, dude, it's in the golden rule.
There's that also.
Love thy neighbor as you love yourself. And it's like, that means I have to love myself foundationally before I can really know what it is to love you.
But myself is not just this human, you know, body. If all things are connected, myself is all of creation.
Exactly, exactly. It's all one. And obviously, we used to know this. humans were intimately interconnected to the planet, and there was that knowledge. And that is our origination. So it's in us still. It's a spark that we just have to activate and give some nourishment to, so that it can really begin to prosper amongst us, because it is what will ultimately be the antidote to how lost we've become as a species.
Yeah.
I always am fascinated by, you know, we're one species out of billions. Mm-hmm. And yet we live as though it's all about us and for us.
And we're rapidly being shown that that's not true, right? It's a flawed assumption.
For those who have eyes to see, yes.
Well, I mean, if not, more suffering will be piled upon you until you have sufficient humility to see. Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite evident to many people that things are not going well. And, you know, what we really need to be focusing on is what the solutions are and where
absolutely
are we opposed to, or what's wrong, but what do we want to see and what can we put our energy into? Because
100%.
That's our power. You know, if you're complacent and depressed and angry, you're part of the problem.
Agreed.
You're buying food that was grown in, you know, a destructive manner. You're part of the problem.
Exactly.
Plant-based or anything else, right? If it was grown poorly and you're putting money into it, you're part of the problem. So use your power to create the reality you want to see. That's what we
indeed
all
have. Well, and you know, I'm excited about mycelia.earth and the community that we're all talking about building out, because it becomes a place for people to go and to have that realignment and that connection with others who are talking about the way forward. And as you say, being for as opposed to against is a much healthier way to be for, to have better. It does. And let's go back to selfish, you know, self-interest.
Straight up selfish. Yep. It's totally selfish to do the right thing. Yes. Deal with it.
I think that's where we'll end, because that's just so cool.
My pleasure, Sally.
My pleasure as well. You've been listening to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm your host, Celine Diaris, and with me today has been Dan Kittredge, the founder and executive director of Bionutrient Food Association. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change podcast series is produced by At the Epicenter, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. The podcast and video recordings are made possible by the generous support of people like you. Make a tax-deductible donation or sign up as a monthly supporter by visiting attheepicenter.com/donate. Support packages start at $1 per month. The podcast series is also sponsored by several corporate and organization sponsors. To become a podcast sponsor, visit attheepicenter.com/contact to let us know of your interest. If you found this podcast episode insightful and meaningful, please pass it on by sharing it with a friend or colleague who will also enjoy it. Thank you for tuning in, for your support, and for activating change.